Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The wheels of the cart groaned and creaked as they rolled along the bumpy surface of the dirt road. The water buffalo, pulling the contraption, strained at his yoke. He ignored the occasional flicks of the driver's goad with a toss of his head and a low grunt. He wasn't in a hurry. The walls of the village only slowly receded from view behind them as the cart came down the bluff toward the river and the waiting barge. The river's light brown waters moved no faster than the water buffalo. It was still the dry season, and the river was low and slow, leaving behind baked, cracked, dry land at the edges of the channel. Soon, though, the rains would begin upriver, and gushing torrents of water would spill over the riverbanks. After the waters receded, the fields surrounding the channel would be left with a fresh coating of rich soil, the lifeblood of an agricultural world. Next year's grain would sprout through that thick layer of fertile dirt, enough not only for the villagers, but for the tens of thousands of people waiting in the city just downriver. That was where the flat-bottomed barge grounded on the side of the river would go after it picked up its load of grain here. The three boatmen, stripped to the waist and sweating in the late spring sun, chatted idly as that last cart and its placid water buffalo made their way down the riverbank. When the loading was done, the boatmen handed over a clay seal, pressed with an image of a humped bull and a series of vertical lines, to the villager. One of the boatmen pushed, his feet slipping on the muddy riverbank, while the others steered the barge into the channel with a long pole. Slowly, the barge floated downstream, passing more villages and the occasional larger town, all of them situated above the floodplain. Irrigation channels and drainage ditches cut through the riverbanks at regular intervals, carrying water away from and toward the main channel as necessary. Before long, the city's mud brick walls loomed ahead of them, visible and approaching in the distance. They were massive constructions, as thick as they were tall, separating the thousands of urbanites from the outside world. The boatmen looked forward to a drink of cool water from a deep well, soaking their aching joints in the city's great bath with its waterproof bricks and system of pipes, hearing the rhythmic working of the craftsmen and the haggling of the merchants as they strolled down the wide public streets. They were nearly home. More than 4,000 years ago, the cities of the Indus Valley civilization, in today's India and Pakistan, were some of the most sophisticated places on Earth, the densely populated linchpins of a little-known and fascinating society. Today, we'll try to understand how these enormous cities came into existence, how they functioned, and why they finally fell apart. Also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I'm reading, of course, from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there, and it would really help me out. Enjoy. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. 4,000 years ago, South Asia was home to one of the most densely populated, urbanized, and sophisticated cultures in the world. Mud brick cities with tens of thousands of inhabitants and big monumental buildings studded the plains surrounding the Indus River and what is today India and Pakistan. Dense trade networks carried huge quantities of food, raw materials, and finished goods over hundreds of miles. Underlying this world of cities and trade was a common set of beliefs and ideas, things that were very different from what was happening further to the west in Mesopotamia or Egypt, or to the east in China. Instead of kings looking down on their subjects from the heights of a palace or a grand temple, an often brutal hierarchy, we see something much more egalitarian and open. That was one of the ways the Indus Valley civilization, as this long-lasting culture and way of life is known, represented a unique and fascinating alternative to the other old world civilizations of this period. Its size alone is worth noting. It covered a much larger area than Egypt or Mesopotamia. More people probably called the world of the Indus Valley home than lived in either of those others. It used a whole variety of strategies to grow and distribute food. It occupied vastly different environments, everywhere from the coast of the Arabian Sea to the foothills of the Himalayas. And rather than appearing during a period of favorable climate, the Indus Valley civilization seems to have reached its peak at a time of climatic stress. It flourished for 700 years. It covered a vast span of time and space, weathered floods, droughts, and changing temperatures for centuries. And then, around 1900 BC, it finally fell apart for good. People abandoned the great cities or built small settlements within the once huge urban centers. They abandoned the common cultural practices and ideas that had bound people together everywhere from the mouth of the Indus and Gujarat to the edge of the great mountains in the north. An age of fragmentation replaced one of integration, and this happened very quickly. It's one of the classic textbook examples of collapse that we can see in the human past. Today, we're going to try to understand this Indus Valley civilization. What it actually was, where it came from, what it was like to live in it, and why it fell apart. And yet, despite its collapse, the Indus Valley civilization is one of the foundational pieces of South Asia's history. Millions and millions of people living today are descended from the inhabitants of the Indus Valley civilization. In that way, and many others, its legacy lives on thousands of years after its people left the cities and their way of life behind. So let's start by talking about what the Indus Valley civilization actually was. This is harder than it might seem because it gets us into some really basic questions about the relationship between material culture, political groupings, social structure, economic ties, language, and a whole bunch of other things. Those connections aren't straightforward. When we're trying to unravel the nature of a society or a civilization over hundreds of years and thousands of miles solely on the basis of the material culture, that's not actually a straightforward task. Why do some characteristic objects or settlement forms or types of buildings lead us to talk in terms of a civilization but not others? We talked about this a little bit with Uruk a couple of months ago, if you'll recall. Was the Uruk phenomenon of the 4th millennium BC a colonizing society? Was it an empire? Was it a cultural and material mood? Or was it something else entirely? Basically, how should we interpret the material evidence we see in the ground? What should our framework for understanding it be? When we define the Indus Valley civilization, what we're really talking about is a series of shared characteristics that were spread over a large area. The area extends from Balochistan in western Pakistan today, next to the Arabian Sea, along the coast past the mouth of the Indus River to Gujarat, then up the Indus River Valley, curving along almost all the way to Kashmir in the north and toward what is now today New Delhi. Now, this is a really, really big area. By one measure, it's about 10 times the size of Mesopotamia and 20 times the size of Egypt. This is a little misleading because settlement was concentrated in specific areas, but it's almost certain that there were more people living in the world of the Indus Valley at its peak than in either Egypt or Mesopotamia. Now, the most basic shared thing in this world was the settlement system, what we would call a settlement hierarchy. A settlement hierarchy means that there were different kinds of settlements in proximity to one another, which were linked to one another. Different sizes, and most of all, different functions. At the top of the Indus Valley civilization settlement hierarchy were four, or more likely five, really, really big cities. I mean, really big, as many as 50,000 inhabitants and maybe more. They were spread widely over this big region. Dholavira in Gujarat in the south, Mohenjo-Daro along the lower Indus, Gondwariwala in what is now the middle of the desert in Cholistan, Harappa in the Punjab, and Rakhigari in Haryana, about 150 kilometers or 100 miles northwest of Delhi. Below these really big cities were dozens of smaller cities, or large towns with a few thousand inhabitants. There were at least 1,000 villages, which were either agricultural or industrial in nature. Now, these places were all tied together by their functions. Raw materials might be collected in one place, transported to another to be made into finished goods, and then transported again to their place of consumption. The key thing is that despite the huge geographic range these cities and smaller settlements covered, despite their varying sizes and functions, they shared a whole bunch of common characteristics. They used the same system of weights and measures. They used the same kinds of seals to mark goods. They shared a written script, which is still undeciphered, but which probably represents a shared language. Of course, there were variations from region to region and settlement to settlement, but they shared these things in common. That is why we can call it the Indus Valley Civilization. Scholars have a specific way of talking about the Indus Valley Civilization that really gets at the heart of what it was. They call its peak the Era of Integration. That's because integration is really what this was all about. People living in Harappa, 850 kilometers or more than 500 miles from the ocean up the Indus River, were eating salted or dried fish caught along the coast. People living in Rakigari, 300 kilometers or 200 miles east of Harappa, used mud bricks made to the same dimensions. Indus Valley merchants from Mohenjo-Daro, who had traveled abroad to live and trade in Mesopotamia, used the same system of weights as they did in Harappa, hundreds of miles from their home city and over 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers to the east of their current residence. Integration means that goods, people, and ideas traveled over this whole huge area. They bound it together into a coherent whole, united by aspects of material culture, belief, urbanism, social and political organization, and probably other things that are now totally lost to us. But this age of integration, also known as the mature Harappan, did not pop up out of nowhere. It's not like one day there was nothing and the next there were these huge cities. The age of integration began in 2600 BC, but it was preceded by centuries of developments and shifts. What scholars call the age of regionalization that came before the time of integration. If we want to make sense of that process and those roots, and we should want to because the birth of a civilization is a pretty important thing, we've got to go all the way back to a place called Mehrgarh. We talked about Mehrgarh in last week's episode. It was the farming village located in the uplands of Balochistan, what's now Pakistan, where we see some of the earliest evidence of agriculture in South Asia. The residents were herding goats, growing wheat and barley, and later domesticating the humped zebu cattle native to the region, all from a very early date, around 7000 BC. The really cool thing about Mehrgarh is that we can see the whole sequence of development from the very beginning. It starts with basic agriculture and a small settlement without even any pottery. Over the next few thousand years, we see the settlement get bigger and bigger, the farming get more intensive, the domestication of zebu, and the growth of all sorts of craft industries, especially pottery making. Pottery making became highly specialized, technologically advanced with high-temperature kilns and the use of the potter's wheel, and it was done on an almost industrial scale. This pottery was then exported throughout the whole area around Mehrgarh. Essentially, we can see, in one single spot, the development of an entire complex society. Now, Mehrgarh obviously wasn't the only settlement in the region, it's just the one we know best. All of them, so far as we can tell, were growing and showing more evidence for craft specialization and increasing scale around this time. Mehrgarh technically lies outside what would later become the Indus Valley Civilization. It's further west and further up in the hills, but the site and its neighbors were intimately connected to the age of integration we talked about. You see, as Mehrgarh and the other settlements in Balochistan got bigger, as their populations grew, those people needed somewhere to go. And so they seem to have migrated, heading to the east and south into the rich plains of the Indus Valley. The Indus Valley turned out to be far more welcoming and suitable for the way of life they'd already developed than Balochistan had ever been. The Indus Valley had the potential to be one of the richest agricultural regions in the world. The Indus is partially fed by snowmelt from the mountains, so it's always flowing. But the huge annual rainfall of the monsoon means that it regularly swells its banks and floods. Floods, as we talked about in Mesopotamia and Egypt, mean that alluvial soil gets deposited for some distance around the river pretty regularly. That kind of thick, nutrient-rich soil is perfect for farming. Those regular floods also provided a great deal of soil moisture that could last even through the exceptionally dry seasons between monsoons. For these early migrants to the Indus Valley, the combination of massive monsoon rainfall, flooding, and exceptional aridity at other times of the years would have been incredibly challenging. But once they figured things out, the Indus had a ton to offer. This process started really slowly in the centuries after about 4000 BC and then picked up speed. We see only one very early site on the lower Indus, a place called Balakot, where the pottery was really similar to what they were making at the same time in the region around Mehrgarh. It's not hard to interpret this as the lone piece of evidence for an early phase of colonization. After 3600 BC, as far as we can tell, again, the pace quickened. More than 20 sites are known from this next phase, called the Amri phase, after its first site. Again, we can be fairly certain that this was colonization rather than local inhabitants adopting the culture of the Baluchistan uplands. It appears as a fully formed package, very similar to what we see in Baluchistan. The same kinds of pottery and technology, same humped cattle dominating the domesticated animals, and so on. The only differences are in some of the foods that people were eating. In Mehrgarh, hundreds of miles from the sea, people obviously weren't eating much shellfish or marine fish. But at these new sites on the lower Indus, they were. So around 3200 BC, after a few centuries of colonization, we start to see some really striking developments in the Indus Valley. The term for this, for those of you who are curious, is called the Côte d'Igi phase. This was a phase that archaeologists used to call pre-Indus or pre-Harappan, or occasionally early Indus or early Harappan, but it's not at all separate from what came later. In fact, the Côte d'Igi phase pointed in the direction of practically all the major facets that would define the Indus Valley civilization proper. During the Côte d'Igi phase, new settlements were built all across the Indus Valley region. They weren't little haphazard collections of houses and fields, but really big, pre-planned, almost cities. The site of Rehman Deri, about 400 kilometers or 250 miles northeast of Mehrgarh, right on the edge of the Indus River, was founded around 3300 BC. From the very beginning, Rehman Deri had a rigid grid pattern to its streets and fortification walls. It enclosed an area of about 22 hectares. Archaeologists usually use hectares to measure site size, by the way. Now, 22 hectares is a lot of space. It's about 54 acres, the size of 40 American football fields or 30 full-sized soccer pitches. Archaeologists estimate that around 12,000 people lived there. Now, a city that was planned from the very beginning to have enough space for 12,000 inhabitants is something really fascinating and special. And that's just one of a whole bunch of sites that were built and planned along similar lines in the centuries leading up to 2600 BC. They had pottery forms that pointed to later developments. They had the regular planning that defined later Indus Valley cities. They even had markings that looked like the distinctive written script that was going to show up all over the region. Massive platforms made of mud brick and on a scale that suggests they were major undertakings start to show up around this time. They continue throughout that later period too. All of this led up to what we call the era of integration, the Indus Valley civilization, or alternatively, the mature Harappan. Sites like Rehman Deri, dating to this period, are important because they show us that the Indus Valley civilization had its roots in exactly the region where it later appeared. A much older generation of scholars assumed that urbanism and, well, civilization had been imported to South Asia from Mesopotamia. We now know with the utmost certainty that wasn't the case. The Indus Valley civilization was homegrown. Its roots were in South Asia, that's where it grew, and that's where its impact would be felt for millennia to come.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.
So we can start to see the roots of what would become the Indus Valley civilization by around 3500 BC. That's roughly the same time when Uruk was growing into an urban powerhouse in Mesopotamia, and the petty kings along the Nile were beginning to compete for supremacy. Migrants were moving into the Indus Valley from Balochistan, bringing with them their way of life and adapting their package of crops and animals to their new environment. They started with a few villages, but before long, they expanded to building large, pre-planned settlements with walls, grids of streets, and monumental mud brick platforms. Now, not everybody lived in these new small cities. They were simply at the top of a settlement hierarchy that included everything from camps for nomadic herders to tiny farming villages with a few dozen inhabitants, to large towns that specialized in particular kinds of raw material extraction or maybe the production of pottery. In other words, we're seeing the establishment of a unique, complex society in the Indus Valley. Complex societies appear worldwide, and we've talked about them quite a bit in different contexts over the past few months. Remember, social complexity is not a value judgment, and it doesn't work in straight lines. It's just an umbrella term for a series of characteristics. One of those is settlement hierarchy, with different settlements serving different purposes in an integrated whole. Another is craft specialization, with different people doing different specialized jobs like making pottery, farming, herding, or smelting metal. We start to see monumental buildings, whether those are palaces or platforms or even just big walls. We see the kind of large-scale agriculture necessary to support people who aren't growing or collecting food for their living. And finally, we see the emergence of some kind of political structure binding the various parts of the society together. To go from a complex society to quote-unquote civilization, whatever value that term has, we might add urbanism, the written word, and last but not least, social hierarchies. Starting in that Côte d'Igie phase and culminating around 2600 BC with the era of integration, we start to see a whole bunch of these characteristics in the Indus Valley. But not all complex societies and civilizations are the same. This is a set of guidelines and tools to think with, not a checklist where you gotta tick every box. The human experience is variable, and it does not conform to a straightforward, linear path. There are a bunch of things about the world of the Indus Valley that seem to run against the grain of what we've come to expect from early civilizations. The biggest difference, the one that demands explanation and analysis, is the apparent lack of a political elite and a sophisticated, firm social hierarchy. That's right. As far as we can tell, and very unlike Mesopotamia and Egypt, the Indus Valley civilization did not have a group of people at the top of society who were dominating the rest through charisma, ideological power, or simple brute force. We don't see the emergence of exclusionary elite strategies, where the powerful found ways of marking themselves off from the rest of society, institutionalizing inequality. That's the kind of thing that marked the growth of quote-unquote civilization elsewhere. It just doesn't show up. There's no fancy tombs. There's no monuments that seem to have been intended to exalt a powerful individual. There's no clear evidence for palaces or even huge temples. And yet, we still see enormous, widespread evidence for centralization, for collective action, and planning. We talked about those huge pre-planned settlements with walls and grids of streets, and monumental buildings like the mud brick platforms. There were also large water management projects, something that would have been absolutely essential in the conditions of the Indus Valley. But they were accomplished without, again, so far as we can tell, the kinds of extreme hierarchies and power relations we see elsewhere in the ancient world. That is a genuine conundrum. When we try to understand the emergence of complex societies and states in the ancient world, we are conditioned to think that those things came about because some folks consciously went about accumulating power. Once they had acquired that power, they could make other people in society do things they wanted them to do. Build temples or pyramids, dig irrigation ditches, fight wars, and most of all, hand over their surplus production. In this line of reasoning, political and social hierarchy was a precondition for the development of quote-unquote civilization. Now, to be clear, this does not mean that Indus society was completely egalitarian, that there were no differences in rank or status, or that what differences existed didn't matter. But it was much more egalitarian than Egypt or Mesopotamia. For one thing, it had no obvious king-like leaders at the pinnacle of its social hierarchy. It had no managerial elite class who drove and benefited from coercion and political control. This was essentially what the earliest excavators and analysts of the Indus Valley civilization thought almost a century ago. It's been a topic of argument and debate ever since then. How can you have an obviously complex society with large cities, huge buildings, public works including large baths, public platforms, and water management systems, and settlements of various sizes, all connected by sophisticated trade networks? How can you have all that without stratified hierarchical social relations? A lot of scholars have said, well, you just can't. So they've tried to reinterpret the Indus Valley society as a hierarchical one. The archaeologist Adam Green recently wrote a fantastic review article entitled Killing the Priest King on this exact topic. Green points out that these revisionist accounts have used their assumptions about the necessity of social hierarchy to drive their interpretation of the evidence, rather than letting the evidence drive their interpretations. And the evidence, so far as we can tell, provides very little support for the idea of an elite that tried to monopolize resources and dictate how their underlings should act. In the case of the Indus Valley, the evidence that is so pervasive in Mesopotamia and Egypt, big tombs, palaces, and whatnot, it just isn't there. It doesn't exist. As a note, I'm drawing on Green's Killing the Priest King article for this following section. So, if not hierarchy and elite domination, then what? People were obviously working on large-scale collective projects. They were obviously planning them. But if they weren't being coerced into digging and building, then why do it? The answer that Green and other recent scholars working on the Indus Valley suggest is a more subtle model of action based on consensus, cooperation, and also competition between different groups within society. Basically, this line of reasoning focuses on the Indus Valley's heterarchy rather than its hierarchy. Instead of looking for vertical rankings that cut through society through ties of coercion, dominance, and exclusion, we're looking for horizontal connections that span across society that bring people together. Any society, the society of the Indus Valley included, incorporates different corporate groups. These could range from individual households to larger kin groupings to occupational groups to whole social classes that sought to raise themselves above the others. In that last case, of course, we'd be dealing with a class-based hierarchy, which doesn't seem to be the case in the Indus Valley. Now, we can see these corporate groups in Indus Valley society in a whole bunch of different ways, but let's start with the layout of the cities themselves. In a really basic sense, the way we organize space speaks volumes to how we think about and organize society as a whole. If you've got a really big, fortified, fancy palace on a hill that looms over a bunch of ramshackle huts, well, you're probably talking about a society with extreme, institutionalized inequality and deeply coercive power relations. We see precisely the opposite in the cities of the Indus Valley. Mohenjo-Daro was probably the largest of the Indus Valley urban sites, and spanned about 250 hectares, which is about 2.5 square kilometers or a square mile. It had tens of thousands of inhabitants. Now, when they excavated Mohenjo-Daro, archaeologists didn't find any palaces or massive temples. They just found neighborhoods full of houses, hundreds of them. These houses, made from mud brick, varied in size, shape, and layout, but they were pretty much all sizable, well-built structures. There were differences of degree between them rather than differences of kind. They were connected to an intricate, citywide system of drainage pipes that supplied private bathing platforms. This was a massive public investment, the drainage system, that enabled a private household amenity, the bathing platforms. It was probably one with some ritual, social, or religious significance. These houses were multi-story, with a dozen or more rooms, often arranged around an internal courtyard. They were densely packed together with one another on a regular, rectilinear pattern of streets. Mohenjo-Daro itself was subdivided into neighborhoods, separated by walls, ramps, gateways, and even guard rooms. So let's put this in concrete terms. You're walking through Mohenjo-Daro around 2500 BC. You're going down a wide, clean public street. You're rubbing shoulders with dozens or hundreds of other people. You pass by a huge elevated platform built of mud brick, topped with large public buildings. You could go into them if you wanted to. You'd then go past a walled neighborhood full of houses and come to a small, open public structure with several wide open doorways and benches running along the outside underneath an awning. This small public building, maybe for administration, sat at the junction of two neighborhoods. You continue into this next quarter of the city. The public street narrows into a private lane. It's flanked by multi-story houses made from mud brick. You turn and walk through the gateway. You pass through darkness into an open courtyard at the center. There's a well inside, from which the residents are drawing water. Inside one of the rooms facing the courtyard, you hear a harsh scraping sound as the craftsman grinds down stone into small, delicate pieces of beadwork. In other houses elsewhere in the city, these craftspeople nap flint, smelt copper, or shape fine pottery. There's no separate industrial or craft district. These activities all take place within the houses. If we exit and head into a different neighborhood, a different set of houses packed wall to wall along their narrow lanes, we might see different crafts or different fashions in jewelry, clothing, beadwork, or what have you, but no real differences in affluence. At this moment in our understanding of the Indus Valley civilization, this is the interpretation that best fits the evidence. Many different groups within society, living in separate neighborhoods and households, but united by a common material culture, set of exchange networks, and probably sets of religious beliefs and language. But, to be honest, we frankly don't know what the basis for membership in those different groups was. Maybe it was based on descent from a common ancestor. Maybe it was based on occupation and craft specialty. Maybe it was based on geographic origin. Maybe it was devotion to a particular deity or set of deities. Maybe it was some combination of those identities that encompassed multiple things. We just don't know at this point, but I'd bet that some clever and resourceful scholars will develop some ideas. Nor can we be entirely sure just how collective action worked in the context of this society, though we can tell its scale must have been enormous. Just one large mud brick platform at Mohenjo-Daro, even leaving aside the buildings built on top of it, has been estimated to require some 4 million days of labor. That's 10,000 people working for more than a year just for the platform. And that's only one example of a large public structure at Mohenjo-Daro. The Great Bath was a huge building made from mud bricks waterproofed with bitumen, and it had a sophisticated supply and drainage system that allowed for control of the level and the temperature of the water. That's an incredible accomplishment 2,000 years before the Romans were building bathhouses. It would have required an enormous amount of work. Okay, so let's say the Indus cities did lack a ruling class. But maybe each city dominated its rural hinterland. Maybe the urbanites extracted resources and surplus from the smaller communities surrounding them. But again, this doesn't seem to have been the case. So far as we can tell, the large towns and villages of Indus society were organized along similar lines, with their corporate groups, their equal exchanges of goods, and their collective action. They traded with the people of the cities. They built the same kinds of planned, regular settlements, just smaller versions, and they used the same weights and measures that were supposed to guarantee reciprocity and fairness. They engaged in the same kinds of collective building projects. Nor do we see any real evidence for warfare, either internal or external. There's no visual vocabulary of power and political violence like we see with the smiting scenes in pre- or early dynastic Egypt. This doesn't mean that people never had conflicts. There's skeletal evidence for interpersonal violence, for example. But we don't see major wars, much less war as an animating ideology. Now, I'm not trying to paint the Indus Valley civilization as some kind of ancient lost paradise. We have no idea what conflict between the corporate groups within Indus cities entailed and who lost out. The process that led to the initial efflorescence of the integration period around 2600 BC seems to have been marked by violence. There's evidence for layers of destruction and burning at multiple sites right at that time. Some areas that had been really central to the prior era of regionalization basically seem to have lost out in the era of integration. Their towns never grew to number among those five big cities of the Indus Valley world. This speaks to what may have been the downside of Indus Valley life. We have no real idea what it looked like to be excluded from this cultural complex and everything that went along with it. If internal divisions weren't all that important, maybe those between people within the Indus Valley and those outside it were what mattered. The key takeaway from all this, at least from my perspective and that of some really cool recent work, is that we should question our assumptions about the relationship between hierarchy, domination, and civilization. Maybe the things that we consider to be markers of human achievement, like writing, cities, cool gadgets and craft products, and a high standard of living, maybe they don't have to come about because of power-mongering elites or the suffering of the masses. It's entirely possible that future research into the Indus Valley civilization will prove that they had elites all along. We were looking in the wrong places or misconceptualizing the whole package. But for now, at least, we have what looks like a strong counter-argument to the models we draw from Mesopotamia, Egypt, and the Yellow River. Maybe, just maybe, civilization doesn't have to be built on the backs of the downtrodden.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nothing lasts forever, and the Indus Valley civilization was no exception. After around 1900 BC, the tight networks that had bound together the vast spaces between Dolaveira in the south, Rakhigari in the northeast, Harappa in the northwest, and Mohenjo-Daro in the west started to fall apart. People abandoned the cities and left behind the way of life that had defined them and their world for centuries. The end of the Indus Valley civilization is a classic example of collapse. Much smaller numbers of people lived among the ruins of once great cities. They no longer built the sophisticated drainage systems, baths, or public buildings. They stopped using the distinctive Indus script and the common system of weights and measures. The raw materials that had traveled hundreds of miles to be made into finished goods and were then redistributed back across the Indus world, well, they stopped moving. Whatever ideas and concepts had underpinned the Indus Valley civilization lost their power. We need to answer one big question. Why did the Indus Valley civilization collapse? Actually, not to be a tease, but before we answer that question, we need to return to a second one, the question with which we began today's episode. What actually was the Indus Valley civilization? We can be pretty sure that it wasn't an empire, a single hierarchical state with an elite group and a ruler at the top. At the same time, we know that it wasn't purely a shared material style. There had to be a common ideology, some way of understanding and explaining and ordering the world that was shared widely from the Arabian Sea to the Himalayan foothills. Whatever this ideology was, it powered the era of integration that we consider the peak of the Indus Valley civilization, where people and goods could move over long distances within this common framework. As we talked about earlier, we can be fairly sure that it was reasonably egalitarian rather than hierarchical and exclusionary, that it was focused around corporate groups within society, acting collectively to build and maintain infrastructure and shared projects for common benefit, and that each of its four or five major cities acted as the focal point for a settlement hierarchy, with large towns, industrial settlements, and farming villages tied to it in the surrounding area. These major cities, places like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, presumably competed with one another in some way. Maybe we should think of them as city-states, each of which had its own distinct elements, styles, and practices while sharing the same fundamental culture and way of life. We know they also featured plenty of internal competition between those corporate groups we talked about, between craft specialists of various kinds and ritual specialists, maybe priests and merchants and landowners. It was this tension between competition and cooperation that seems to have created the shared world of the Indus Valley. To share this homogeneous culture with its regular grid plans, its mud brick walls, its water management systems, and its egalitarian ethos, the only explanation is sustained interaction between people from all over the region. They must have moved around all the time, either temporarily to transport goods and whatnot, or permanently from village and town to city and vice versa. If this kind of movement and shared culture, this integration, is what defined the Indus Valley civilization, well, then this must also be what fell apart. It took a long time for the Indus Valley civilization to come into being in the first place. The era of regionalization that preceded the era of integration lasted just as long, and it wasn't a smooth, continuous transformation from one to the other. The transition from regionalization to integration lasted less than a century. In the course of just a few generations, the people of the Indus Valley built these huge cities in classic, recognizably Indus Valley form, with their grid patterns and their big comfortable houses and their subdivided neighborhoods and their public buildings. People must have moved into them from the countryside, drawn by whatever ideological and material attraction was on offer. Around 2600 BC, when the era of integration began, cities like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro were full of people whose grandparents could not have conceived of an urban place that big. There was a long lead-up to the beginning of the era of integration. Various elements came into being in various places within that vast region that would become the Indus Valley civilization. Weights and measures in one place, seals and the still undeciphered script in another, and pottery styles in another still. Then, they came together with shocking speed to create the era of integration and whatever shared order went along with it. I want to be really clear about this. Even the people who are doing cutting-edge work on the Indus Valley civilization are pretty open about the fact that we don't have great conceptual frameworks for understanding exactly what it was. We can't be sure what the people who lived there called themselves. We can't be sure what language they spoke, though I'm most convinced that it's probably something related to Proto-Dravidian. We don't know how they conceived of their world. Our best guess, based on contemporary Sumerian texts, is that their land was called something like Melucha, but we can't be sure about that. Whatever it was, this doesn't fit the models and the categories we're used to employing. It doesn't fit states, it doesn't fit classes, it doesn't fit elites. It was definitely something. And the failure to really get it says a lot more about us than it does about these long past people. But hopefully now we have a better grasp of exactly what fell apart. It was those networks of integration that tied the cities, towns, and villages of the Indus Valley together. Those networks came together really quickly in the first place, and then they fell apart with equal speed. Over the course of just a few generations, less than a century, the big cities lost their tens of thousands of residents. The canals and drains filled up with debris. The sophisticated craft workshops fell silent. The profusion of boats and animal-drawn carts going from village to town, town to city, and city back to village stopped moving. They stopped doing their work of connecting and integrating, and this shared world disappeared. But why did this happen? Was it war? Were the cities of the Indus Valley destroyed by a foreign invasion? Or should we blame a rising tide of internal strife? What about epidemic disease, environmental degradation, or climate change? The answer, as with most of the complex questions that are worth asking in the first place, is hard to pin down. A much older generation of scholars blamed these so-called Aryan invasions for the downfall of the Indus Valley civilization. One theory was that these chariot-riding speakers of Indo-European languages, the future authors of the Rig Veda, swept down from what's now Central Asia and Afghanistan, destroying the old order and setting themselves up in South Asia for good. That was the thinking, at least. We can pretty firmly say that it's not true. Indo-European speakers did migrate to South Asia. They did bring their language with them. They did bring some of their myths and pieces of their way of life, and of course their genes. We'll talk about that topic, which isn't without controversy and analytical difficulties, in a later episode. But we can pretty firmly say that the Indo-Aryans, whoever they were, arrived after the cities of the Indus Valley had already been abandoned. Internal strife is a bit harder to answer, but we can probably discount that one too. There's no evidence for widespread destruction or a massive wave of violent conflict. There are some apparently unburied skeletal remains from Indus Valley sites that date to the end of the period we're talking about, but as far as we can tell, those people died of disease. We have reason to think that people were less healthy toward the end of the era of integration, starting around 2000 BC, than they had been in the centuries before. A bioarchaeological study of remains from Harappa, led by the anthropologist Gwen Robbins Shug, found more evidence of trauma and violence, skeletal pathologies, and leprosy as time went on. One group of remains buried outside the cemetery proper, and thus probably consisting of outcasts from society, suffered the highest rates of violent injury and disease. It's not hard to see all of this as evidence for some kind of increasing social stress in Indus Valley society as we get closer to the end. But what was the source of that social stress? We know disease was growing more prevalent, but pathogens, especially those like leprosy, are more likely to be an indicator of ongoing stress than its root cause. Environmental degradation is more plausible. The people of the Indus Valley civilization required enormous amounts of fuel to make mud bricks, which presumably led to deforestation. Their high population densities meant intensive farming, which could exhaust or oversalinate soils due to overuse. Intensive grazing of domestic animals, which we know was absolutely central to Indus society, could have the same effect. Lots of people living in the same places for centuries were bound to eventually run into some environmental constraints. Still, this explanation seems incomplete. Could people over this whole enormous area, which encompassed much of present-day South Asia, really have degraded all of their varied environments and done so on precisely the same timescale? That seems unlikely. We need a little more. This brings us around to the climate. Around 2100 BC, the annual monsoon, the source of so much soil moisture, river flow, and the fertile alluvial soils for farming, started to dramatically and quite suddenly weaken across this whole region. The Indus itself is ultimately fed by meltwaters in the Himalayas, so it was going to flow regardless, but the monsoon rains were what allowed it to flood. Regular flooding deposited fresh, nutrient-rich soil in which the farmers could plant their crops. Without regular flooding, which presumably decreased along with the monsoon, it's easy to see how soils could become exhausted and oversalinated. The effects could have been even more devastating away from the Indus itself, particularly along a river called the Ghaggar-Hakra, the east of the Indus. Now, the Ghaggar-Hakra may only have flowed seasonally with the monsoons, but that would have been plenty to produce flooding and water that could be stored for irrigation. A large number of Indus Valley civilization sites have been found along this dried-up channel. But as the monsoon weakened, the Ghaggar-Hakra could no longer have supported the people who lived there. All of this seems fairly convincing. It's definitely our best shot at a causal explanation, but we're still only getting part of the story here. First, the Indus Valley civilization spanned a huge area and many different climatic zones. A weakening of the monsoon wouldn't have affected the upper reaches of the Indus in the same way as the fringes of the Thar Desert or the hills of Balochistan. No climatic event or process has an even identical outcome over space and time. Different places are affected differently, based on local weather patterns, geology, hydrology, and many other factors. Second, and even more important, people are not passive pawns. They're not pure victims of climate change, without any power or agency to affect their fates. Environmental conditions and changing climates set the parameters within which people operate. Rainfall, temperature, floods, all of that. But people can and do take actions to maximize their chances of survival and prosperity. The people of the Indus Valley, far from throwing up their hands in dismay and giving up, actively adapted themselves and their way of life to their changing conditions. Their society didn't collapse immediately when the monsoon weakened around 2100 BC. Instead, it lasted for at least two centuries more before the cities were finally abandoned. In fact, the Indus Valley civilization had only come into existence after a preliminary weakening of the monsoon around 3000 BC. People living there were already used to climatic fluctuations. They had built their whole civilization around a world without superabundant rainfall. In other words, the Indus Valley civilization showed tremendous resilience and adaptability from the very beginning. Based on the emphasis on water management systems like drains, canals, artificial channels, and the like, we know that water was central to the practical way of life in the Indus Valley. There are so many public and private facilities for bathing that it's a safe bet that water had some real ritual, religious, or ideological significance too. It's not especially surprising that they were adaptable and skilled enough to try new things as the monsoons weakened. We know they started trying new packages of crops, different configurations of domesticated animals, different water management systems. These people weren't fools. They were every bit as intelligent and motivated to survive as we are today. In the end, though, their society simply couldn't handle the full weight of changing times and conditions. Given how integrated the world of the Indus Valley was, it's not hard to imagine that some areas might have been disproportionately affected by the weakened monsoon or exhausted soils. This could set off refugee crises, break down networks of trade, or starve a major city that depended on importing food. And when one link in a chain breaks, the others are much more likely to break too. This, at least right now, is the best explanation we have for the collapse of the Indus Valley civilization. It's not a simple story of climate change wreaking havoc, but one of changing conditions, people doing their best to respond, and ultimately deciding to try something different. That, not just as some sort of collapse or failure, is how we should view the end of the Indus Valley civilization. They left their cities behind. They abandoned some of their permanent settlements. They started to herd more animals. they moved from place to place as pastoralists among the ruins of their old cities. Others left the region altogether. They headed east toward the Ganges or south into the Deccan. And this way, the legacy of the Indus Valley civilization lived on for millennia. It forms part of the heritage that continues to shape South Asia today. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to head back to the West. We haven't been there in quite some time, and now it's time for us to see what the Bronze Age in Europe was like. We'll try to understand migrations, megaliths and monuments, and most of all, new religions and ways of organizing society. Until then, thanks for joining me. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and videos in a post to go along with each episode. I also write essays on current events in a historical perspective, but feel free to skip those if you just want the prehistory. Again, that's patrickwyman.substack.com. As I mentioned earlier, I've written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in the episode description that'll take you there. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman, on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick, or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.